Hi, Matt.
And hi, Matt. Is it always Matt or Matthew? What's your sort of division of labor on your name?
I don't know. I think I go for Matt, you know, in real life, but Matthew in sort of words,
okay.
Printed words.
And you don't find that sort of you know, dual personality thing kind of confusing?
You know, I mean, over time, I forget who I am. It's sort of like, you know, those hard-boiled movies about undercover cops,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I start to lose
you're
it.
In too deep.
Exactly. Too deep into the Matthew persona.
Explain to everybody who you are and make sure you get those details right about the action fund and whatever, lest you get a bad letter from your in-house PR department.
Exactly. As I emphasize on these Blogging Heads TVs, I'm Matthew Iglesias, and I'm a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
Right.
Not, as is commonly assumed, Center for American Progress. At least my blog isn't. I don't totally understand the difference.
Right.
But it was discussed in my last Blogging Heads.
I'm sure this is for sort of tax disclosure reasons, so that you're not investigated for fraud or something?
Precisely so.
Yeah.
Precisely so. If I were to say something unduly political advocacy-ish,
right.
We wouldn't want to imply that tax-exempt C3 dollars went to contribute to that in any way.
We actually go through that in that we're not supposed to, specifically endorse or candidates and things like that, which is actually not too much of a problem for us, as you can well imagine, not being fond of most politicians anywhere near power. But it's one of the many things that people don't realize about 501c3s that are funding publications is that you have to be a lot more careful with the way that you speak, which
yes, indeed. I actually, though, you know, I would sort of think that the non-endorsing might be a bigger problem for a publication like Reason than, say, you know, when I worked at the American Prospect, it was the same thing. Magazine, 501c3, didn't endorse candidates. But I think precisely because it's so obvious from, you know, the American Prospect's ideological point of view that if you agreed with that magazine, you would support Barack Obama rather than John McCain.
Right.
You know, there was sort of like, there was no issue about not endorsing candidates. Whereas, I mean, with Reason, right? I mean, there's like a more interesting question to ask about Reason writers as to, like, who should you vote for?
In that, like, it's actually a more contested kind of question.
Right. Like, it's not, you know, totally obvious to me from reading some of your writers, like, who, I mean, you know, it's clear that they don't love Democrats or Republicans or blah, 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 but it's not totally clear to me, like, who they would vote for. Whereas I'm not, you know, somehow confused about, you know, conventional liberals or conservatives' views, even if they don't explicitly endorse.
Well, one thing that we do, and we encourage / dare everyone else in the journalistic world to do, is actually disclose who we vote for president at the least every 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
We poll our own staffers and kind of broader world universe of people and say, okay, who did you vote mm-hmm. for last time? Who are you going to vote for this time? Why? And et cetera. And we usually ask a couple of smart-ass questions. And it's a fun exercise because people totally use it against you,
right.
Which is the biggest fear of all. I try to get that done at the LA Times editorial board. I'm like, okay,
uh-huh.
Look, let's maximally disclose everything because my suspicion
right. –
obviously, is that most people would end up disclosing that they vote reliably Democrat, especially for president, but in general.
Right.
And they didn't want to do it because their enemies would say, see, that proves liberal media bias. I think it's interesting information to know your own, journalistic organization. Why not find out? Like, if the Washington Post turns out that 95%
right.
vote for Democrat, that's kind of interesting managerial information. But anyways,
No. I mean, whatever. I mean, it's the only thing. People are not actually interested in politics. They're interested in complaining about people who write about politics. And, you know, why not give them more fodder?
I say give them, maximum fodder. And also, it's a great way to scramble people's brains. Maybe it's because my own voting record is so insane and bizarre, and you wouldn't line it up with your average libertarian, let alone average human, I find it very helpful to say in the course of any given conversation, I voted for, you know, Ralph Nader and I wrote in Jerry Brown in 1992. That's how crazy
uh-huh.
I am.
Sure. Yeah, no, I agree. Well, anyway, we were going to talk about the war in Iraq.
What's that?
It ended this week.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
I'm thrilled. What's you wrote a book about democratic foreign policy and things like that.
Yes.
In the context of your kind of worldview and where you think policy should go, what's the significance of this? Where do you place Obama's Iraq strategy in kind of your ideal chain of events out there?
I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, I was sort of joking about this. There was a good piece in the Times today about the speech where there's this kind of parenthetical down there, and it's a soldier asks Robert Gates, are we still getting combat pay bonuses if we have to serve in Iraq? And he says, yes, I mean, of course they will. The idea that there's a distinction that somehow, because quote unquote combat troops are gone, it'll be over, is a little silly. But I think the important announcement that we've heard from the administration, consistently over the past couple of months is that they're not going to be looking for asterisks or loopholes to keep soldiers in after December of 2011. Personally, I'm not a general. I'm not an expert on military logistics. I would like to see soldiers taken out of Iraq as swiftly as possible, in a way that's safe for them. My guess is that you could probably move somewhat more aggressively than Obama is, but this is a policy that I think is moving in the right direction.
But then, the overall, like, we're going to shift our focus from Iraq and put it into Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is, Obama telegraphed entirely through the campaign, and people who claim to be surprised by that are suckers. But isn't our net kind of overseas involvement in the WOT sort of the same, even with the drawdown in Iraq, and how, where are you with that?
I think it's slightly reduced. I mean, I agree with you. I'm not thrilled with that. I also agree that this was more or less the policy Obama campaigned on. I mean, people have the right to not like the policy, but not to be shocked by it. I'm of two minds about it. I mean, I think that not all overseas military deployments are created equal. It is better to shift resources from Iraq into Afghanistan. At the same time, I've become, pretty left-wing about these kinds of things, and would like to see, just much less military deployments abroad, and less spending on the military, and less emphasis on, war as a tool of American foreign policy than we're seeing from the Obama administration or from anyone I can imagine becoming president anytime soon.
Yeah, I have long since given up trusting my own instincts about foreign policy, and I've just maintained a pretty calm level of depression about it all. My kind of overarching framework has been, I would like us to recede from the notion that we are leading the free world militarily, and taking, lead responsibility in every kind of conflict and issue out there, which is not something that most politicians can get away with saying unless you're Ron Paul or something. And I don't know so far, whether we're going to see, Obama moves in that direction. He emphasized last night at the top of the speech, we still are the leader of the free world and this kind of stuff. You can argue that presidents have to say that. I think that it's sort of inevitable that anyone who ends up in the Oval Office ends up embracing that, because it's a thing that you can control a little bit more than other parts of domestic policy, which will be certainly true of him going forward probably. It's the awesome, terrible burdens of responsibility. Suddenly you find that you need to drastically increase troop levels at the next hotspot. So I remain kind of depressed by that. I think that there's been a gap. I sometimes go back and look through what was said and written about during the mm-hmm. Democratic Convention in 2008, mm-hmm. and there was this great sort of feeling that, like, you know, once we restore honor in our own sense to the White House, then the world is going to X. They're going to embrace us. We're going to finally rebuild our image abroad and this kind of stuff. And I, you know, more people are going to cooperate in whatever we do out there. I think that those dreams are unrealistic at the time, and I think they've been certainly kind of subdued or dashed. And part of that is that, you know, we still can assassinate an American citizen without trial. Guantanamo Bay is still open. A lot of these kind of issues that were that people were super excited about back then and don't talk about nearly as much now are still out there. It's still a 9/14 presidency, as your good friend Eli Lake puts it. And I am pessimistic about that changing anytime soon. But maybe that's just because I'm depressive.
No, I mean, you know, I think there's obviously a lot of sort of structural continuity in American foreign policy, and you see that all the time. I mean, I did a review of Julian Zelizer's book about the politics of foreign policy a few months ago, and, you know, one thing that I thought was interesting, noting, he talked about it on a sort of a long historical trajectory. And one thing that I thought was interesting reading that book is that the main inflection points tend actually not to come when there's a change in partisan control in Washington. That, you know, the Obama administration is different from the Bush administration, but it's similar to the last year or so of the Bush administration, whereas Bush himself actually had a pretty big turnabout on a lot of things, you know, around 2007 or so. And you see that time and again. I mean, the Carter administration, the Reagan administration all had big sort of reversals
Clinton, internally, in
the direction they took things. But then overall, you know, there's a, I mean, you don't want to underplay the extent to which, you know, who's actually running the national security state matters. But at the same time, there's a, you know, there's a lot of continuity over the years. And that seems to be a reality. And I think for those of us who, you know, would want to see bigger changes in national priorities, it's a depressing reality.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, a thing that I took out of the speech and I found to be the most awkward was sort of the guns and butter transition section. It seemed to be kind of internally contradictory in a number of ways. He was talking about how, like, now that we don't have to spend this $1 trillion, you know, this thing led to record deficits and all this, and it also prevented us from making investments in our own people. And it's like, you know, investments in our own people, as defined by, you know, the Democratic Party it currently, actually kind of helps lead to record deficits. You know, it's not as if he's been active on that front. He talked a lot about, like,
well, no, I mean, that's I think you're being silly. I mean, look, right? I mean, you know perfectly well what the story from the administration is about deficits and stimulus and the economic situation. I mean, you might not believe that story. You might think it's wrong, right? But the story is that in response to the downturn, we need to have an important short-term budget deficit. At the same time, it would be better if we hadn't rung up a giant deficit in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. There's nothing inconsistent about that.
Well, it's inconsistent in that, you know, you're making you're putting onto basically Iraq the record deficits. That's not the source of the record deficits at this point. It's a contributor for sure, but to
sure, yes, it's true. I mean,
and
Iraq
we're talking
is
about,
an
and
important
we're talking
contributor
about investing
to the
in our own people. Let's be clear about that. It's not just stimulus.
Right.
It's you know, doing this energy policy that he thinks that we've been putting off the hard questions over the years. It's healthcare reform as he sees it. This is investing in our people. That's not just cushioning
right.
the blow. That's
right, right, but those are not policies that increase the deficit.
They're all policies that increase the deficit.
No, that's not. I mean, look, they were good with you're just wrong. I mean,
That's convincing.
Sorry. Okay. Well, as you know, we have a Congressional Budget Office that does scoring of legislative proposals, and they both score as deficit-reducing proposals, because they're legislative proposals that, if enacted, would reduce the deficit.
I don't think this is a very old argument.
I mean, you've had Peter Suderman has written at great length for your publication about why we shouldn't really believe that the healthcare bill will reduce the deficit, and you know, I mean, we're not going to sort of resolve it up here, but I mean, these are policy initiatives that. Are intended to reduce the deficit, that SCORE is reducing the deficit, and that will reduce the deficit if they are implemented.
That's, I mean, it's nice to say that you're wrong and we won't solve it here, but if anyone has refuted any of Peter Suderman's reporting on this, it's total news to me.
On Peter Suderman, right? I could have this debate with Peter, but I believe that Peter would acknowledge that the bills, if they are implemented, I mean, particularly the healthcare bill, which is passed, if it's implemented as written,
which it won't
then
be,
it will
which
reduce the deficit.
Absolutely won't be. But
that is an entirely different argument, right? I mean, you can't just come in here and say that Obama isn't reducing the deficit when he's passing bills that, if they are implemented, will reduce the deficit.
You know for a fact that they won't be implemented.
Well, listen. I know for an absolute fact that nothing Barack Obama does will reduce the long-term deficit, because in the future, Republicans will get into office and will produce large deficit-increasing tax cuts. I mean, that's my prediction about the future. But if you want to propose policies that reduce the long-term deficit, all you can do is write laws that, if they're implemented, reduce the deficit.
Right, which they haven't done. But anyways, let's move on from that argument.
All right, fair enough.
Talk about thing you wrote actually this morning. There's big increased interest in the largest private company in the United States of America, as far as I know, the Koch Industries,
I thought it was the second.
Second largest. I was just reading some older piece that called it the largest. What's the largest now? Do we know?
I don't know, but I just, I got this factoid off Wikipedia.
Yeah, that must be second. True. Anyways, the Koch Industries, run by Charles and David Koch, they are huge funders and have been for 30 years or so, I don't really know exact, of various libertarian and libertarian/conservative institutions, including Reason Magazine, which I edit, and other outlets. There's a big piece in The New Yorker by Jane Meyer talking about this. There's another one a few weeks prior to that in New York Magazine, which I have not read. But at any rate, you wrote this morning that if the Koch in people's ideology went forward, it would cause massive human suffering, and I'm curious as to what part of kind of libertarian application you think specifically would or does cause massive human suffering.
I think we would have a lot of additional human suffering if we had had no stimulus, which I believe was a position that, you know, Koch organization supported. I think that the Koch's views on climate change in particular are going to be quite destructive to the long-term future of humanity.
Do you think libertarianism in general causes massive human suffering?
No, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put it that way. I mean, I think that the sort of, if I look at what's in the Cato Institute's, you know, handbook of policy, that if that whole agenda was fully implemented, that would be bad, but it would have some good aspects. You know, I'm not sure that the existence of the libertarian movement is a bad thing. I think there are a number of things libertarians tend to advocate for that I believe in and that are good, and also that it's healthy in a, you know, I mean, it's both healthy and inevitable that in a democratic society, you're going to have people advocating for all kinds of different positions. But I mean, the reason liberals don't like the Kochs is that we're liberals and the positions they're funding are different positions. And, you know, I mean, if I thought the Kochs were right, I would change my ideas. But instead, I think they're wrong. So I think it's unfortunate that they're able to, you know, give a lot of money to things that I think are wrong.
I think that people being able to give a lot of money to things is perfectly fine, whether it's true.
No. I don't think it's bad that they have a right to do it. I mean, I wish that they, for example, though, if they would change their minds and give less money to people who I disagree with and more money to me, that that would be good. It's a pretty banal point, I think.
Well, I think it's a pretty tendentious point, although I don't really know what the word tendentious means. Something like that. I'm trying out all of the Connor Friedersdorf vocabulary. I just have a little thesaurus next to me when I read stuff. Vexatious. It's vexatious, damn
Ooh,
it.
Vexatious.
That, you know, the concepts that are championed by libertarians at heart are capitalism, free trade, free exchange of stuff. And I think those concepts are the biggest boon to humanity. We're talking about, like, you know, lifting hundreds of millions of Chinese and Indians out of poverty in the 1990s and the aughts.
Well, look. If what the Kochs were funding was political and economic reform in China and India in the 1990s. I congratulate them for that.
They're funding institutions. I should point out that it's my criticism of the Meyer piece in the New Yorker, and then she's a reporter that I've enjoyed in the past and praised in the past. I would love to see more articles about them because most of it is sort of news to me as well. And I just think that anyone mm-hmm. who's wielding influence in America should be scrutinized to the nth possible degree. That said, she had a premise, basically two premises, that I think break down pretty quickly. One is that they are motivated primarily about self-interest of their companies, and which, you know, if you were, I don't think that you would be spending it on kind of intellectual movement-y think tank stuff. You'd spend it basically on lobbying and rewriting rules and not getting in the way of presidential agendas. But also that, as part of that, they sort of enforce orthodoxy of their bizarre ragbag of self-interested uh-huh. views on the people that they fund. And I think uh-huh. that you could probably testify to some degree working for the Center for American Progress Action Fund that, which is a much more kind of, it's more closely associated with an administration than I think any large Koch donor or recipient has ever been to any administration. Even with all of that, to kind of, say that they are organs directly of their larger funders can break down a lot in reality. And in the reality of us, we were not mentioned in the article except as quoting from Brian Doherty's great book, Radicals for Capitalism, which is about a history of the movement. The whole idea is that they exist basically to fund these things to deny climate change because they're an oil company. It's a good story. Uh-huh. I like the sound of it. And Reason yeah. Magazine, which is, the Kochs are not our biggest donor, as far as I know. Right. We have been advocating, or Ron Bailey, our science correspondent, has been advocating for carbon taxes, saying that humans do cause global warming. I mean, human beings, right. even at these institutions, aren't these automaton sheep that do the bidding of whatever momentary enthusiasm of the wand-waving billionaire. Your thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, my experience with every article that's ever been written about who are the donors behind some kind of nonprofit institution is that every single person who I ever encounter who's like not in DC working professionally in this universe overestimates the extent to which these kind of donors matter and are micromanaging everyone, and there are these like vast nefarious conspiracies around. And then conversely, everyone who's involved in the DC political advocacy nonprofit world gets super defensive and really underestimates it. It's common sense that it matters who gives money to institutions, and it matters what those people are interested in. People do more work gets done on the subjects that there's funding for work to be done on, right?
Totally, yeah.
Right. And, I think, this like connect the dotsy type stuff, winds up going too far. People get too invested in the question of, are the Kochs trying to advance their personal financial interests through their political advocacy, and they've created this broader philosophical umbrella as a very clever smokescreen for that. Or alternatively, do they sincerely believe in a set of principles, many of which, coincidentally or not, you know, align with the interests of some of their businesses they're in? I think if you have any realistic understanding of human psychology and how people motivate themselves, you see that that's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a false choice, right? I mean, people, almost everyone, you know, has a strong desire to believe sincerely in a set of principles and in the idea of themselves as principled. People don't, you know, have this kind of like clucking, like, secretly I know that we should take action against global warming, but I'm going to pretend not to for personal gain. Yeah. You know, people believe in what they believe in, you know, and it's out there. People benefit from what they benefit from. You know, and I think to agree with what you said, that it's just, it's good to have more scrutiny of this kind of thing, in general, you know, what people are up to. It's important to understand what they're doing. What's unfortunately difficult about sort of magazine journalism in particular, I think, is that to do a sort of a big, long piece about the Kochs and their role in political philanthropy, you need to have like a, you know, like a thesis, a, you know, a master story behind the whole thing. When a lot of the times what the world really needs is just kind of information. You know, I mean, like, who are the people giving a lot of money? What institutions do they give money to? What programs at those institutions do they support? You know, that kind of thing.
You know, that's...
And I think a lot of donation is done sort of without a master plan. You know, I mean, people have money, they're interested in politics, they meet a person who they think is impressive, so they give them some money because they get talked into it.
It's, I think that there's some pretty interesting ideas in there, specifically on the information front. And on Meyer's story in particular, I would have found it more valuable as a reader to kind of hear from the people who were, you know, recipients and how they view that world. I mean, whether they you know, interact with these people or not, are they conscious of it? Are they embarrassed by it? Are they proud of it or whatever? But like, how does that happen? And her thing was more of a a dot connecting sort of insinuation exercise that I think did injustice to the Mercatus Center especially, which is not like some, you know, quack for hire kind of group out of George Mason. But in general, it would have made more, just as you're saying, on the information front, wherever that lies. I don't know what the answers would have been. I mean, in our case, in our case, it's not the same as anybody else's in that universe. We were around since 68. I think that predates the Koch's heavy involvement in politics, though I could be wrong about that. And even though David sits on our board of trustees, and I meet with the board of trustees twice a year, I've interacted with him less than I have with George Soros, you know, and also interacted with his ideas less than I have with George Soros.
I think it's
interesting, you know. Certainly our interests align. That's why he's donating money to a magazine that I edit, and it makes,
right.
Or to a foundation that publishes the magazine I edit. And I don't, you know, I don't discount the importance of being able to support these institutions, like I said, and make it, give them more space to do the work that they're doing and that kind of thing. But it is interesting to see exactly how it kind of breaks down in practice, because I think that sometimes, it just gives you more information to chew on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess the point that I think goes sort of under-discussed in these kind of things is just the sort of magnetic pull that donor money has on people's time and attention, you know, people who work inside institutions, that it's not like, you know, phone calls come down and people are like, all right, you guys need to do this. I'm giving you the money. I'm the boss. You know, people with a lot of money tend to be rich businessmen who sort of have better things to do than micromanage nonprofits. But, you know, institutions like Center for American Progress or like Cato or like AEI all, you know, have a whole bunch of people working there who are working on different things. And, you know, the tendency is that when donors are more interested in certain topics, you get more money to hire more people to kind of work on those programs. And that winds up having a sort of important impact on the whole kind of public debate, right? That, you know, if you look at libertarian institutions and liberal institutions, there tend to be many more people at them working on the sort of clash about economic policy than there are people working on topics about, you know, criminal justice policy issues or you know, civil liberties type issues. And that's because, you know, I think it's because most of the money involved in the political system is about economic interests one way or another. And so most of the work that gets done in the political system winds up focusing on those topics, even though they're not necessarily the most important ones.
That's an interesting scenario that raised. I'm not sure whether that works out in practice. I can say in our case, which is the only thing I really know, obviously, libertarianism is at heart an economic philosophy, so you're going to get into that in general a little bit more, though we also, as you know, write a hell of a lot about criminal justice issues
right.
and stuff. And we don't, at this point, you know, that is not a predominant focus of our donor base. I think it's fair to say, I think it should be. It brings up something that also occurred to me. I went back and read Jane Meyer's 2004 profile of George Soros, and I heavily encourage mm-hmm. everyone to read both as a compare and contrast, and just sort of to know where Soros is coming from. I think he's a fascinating and frequently misunderstood character in general. Mm-hmm. But her piece starts with this great sort of Aspen anecdote where five billionaires who hated George Bush got together uh-huh. and tried to figure out you know, how are we going to depose the child clown president that we had?
Right.
And it struck me, and I didn't realize that at the time when I first read it, three of the five are basically three of the biggest donors to marijuana legalization in this country. Mm-hmm. George Soros, Peter Lewis, who has been a big funder of the Marijuana Policy Project, and John Sperling, mm-hmm. the University of Phoenix guy. And, you know, that just sort of like... working for a big legalize it magazine really stuck out because, of course, these people, these, you know, who want to move the needle on this question and have a ton of
right.
money and who've created these institutions,
right.
I just wonder how they're feeling that that particular issue is working out for them under Obama, because we see, you know, the same current drug czar and five previous drug czars writing letters, you know, opposing the legalization of marijuana in California and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't there a small change in federal involvement in California medical marijuana?
Very small, mostly in name only.
Right.
They've continued right. doing raids on dispensaries. They have
right,
a different
right.
justification for it now, basically, and even that has been sort of disappointing from our point of view. And,
well,
and they've stepped back a little bit from the nomenclature of the drug war,
right.
Which I think is very important, even though it doesn't have any sort of statutory implications.
Right. You know, I was going to say, thinking about the Coke stuff over the morning, and specifically with regard to what you're saying about marijuana, it reminded me of a book I read recently by Frank Baumgartner and a bunch of co-authors on it's called Lobbying and Policy Change, and it's an excellent book, and I really recommend people read it. And what it goes to show is that I think that you know, advocates only sort of get their way in Washington when they have some money behind them going into lobbying, that, you know, that entree is critical. But that it's by no means the case that the side with more money always wins. And that mostly what happens in D.C. policy circles is that nothing changes. You know, and that, you know,
right.
huge sums of money are often spent to no effect.
Or to entrench the status quo in the name of
yeah, family. But I mean, you see with marijuana legalization, I mean, that this is a topic that a number of very wealthy individuals are interested in, that they are wealthy individuals who contribute to political causes. And, you know, I mean, they barely move the needle at all. It's just not... you know, the political system is not responsive to the desire of rich people and marijuana smokers to change the law on this. And it's, you know, weirdly, I mean, it's not responsive to the fact that people don't seem in their personal lives to actually think that, you know, like smoking pot is something people should be thrown in jail for.
But
public opinion, though, is like, I think, oddly friendly. I mean, oddly hostile to marijuana legalization, considering the fact that it's like you just never in practice hear like, oh, you know, like my nephew was smoking a joint. That guy belongs in jail.
Well, I mean, public opinion has been moving pretty rapidly on this. And the place where money and sort of political will is affecting change is on wherever public has a chance to vote on this, right? So there's 14 states, I think it is, and maybe a couple more have been added or are going to be added, who have voted on medical marijuana. And as far as I know, they've got a pretty uninterrupted winning streak, you know, whether it's like medical marijuana or saying, you know, we want our local law enforcement to prioritize this last. So I think there is, you know, not throughout the entire country necessarily, but in the decadent, you know, liberal enclaves and elsewhere, there has been movement towards that, and that's where things can impact. I think, in general, looking for, you know, good change on the federal level, you know, I am skeptical that happens very often, and it tends to be kind of a lagging indicator of everything. But, you know, that's another, the whole idea of people over-assuming that money dictates politics is one of the kind of themes that I got out by reading that Soros article in 2004, because that was still in the universe. I forget the guy's name, Rob Stein or whoever, who had the PowerPoint that changed Democrats' way of thinking about stuff. It basically showed all these nefarious billionaires funding a right-wing kind of projects and politics. So the vibe of the piece is that, you know, it's a given that Republicans will always be able to outspend Democrats. There's even a quote from Frank Mankiewicz saying, you know, sort of grappling with the idea that Soros is suddenly throwing around tens of millions of dollars into the political process. And he says something like, you know, I mean, that guy has so much money. It's impossible for me to believe that, you know, this amount of money couldn't tip the election. And, you know, we saw in 2004, I don't know what the spending numbers were, but that it couldn't. Whatever Soros wanted to do didn't work out in 2004. Mm-hmm. And just in general, I think that Democrats have moved away from a little bit through the experience of Barack Obama and stuff from the notion that sort of money is going to dictate what happens out there. I think that is less, you know, and that Wall Street inevitably is going to be Republican, which was no longer the case in 2008. That has been less, I think, of kind of a belief point or talking point, and maybe I'm wrong, than it was. And it's interesting to see, you know, the strength of people's belief in 2004 and the stuff that was making them really excited and upset, and just like how ephemeral that actually turns out to be when experience changes, you know, in 4 and 6 years.
Sure.
I guess.
You know, I mean, it's tough because obviously nobody working in politics professionally, or few people working in politics professionally, are going to spend a ton of time emphasizing the idea that spending more money on politics is a bad idea. You know, there's admissions contrary to interest. I'm very glad personally that this new progressive infrastructure has been built up. I think, you know, if George Soros wants to give me a bunch of money, that's probably a good idea. But yeah, I mean, it gets easy to overestimate these kind of things. You know, politics, federal politics in particular, is mostly a little bit boring. Mostly nothing changes. Presidential elections are mostly determined by the level of economic growth. You know, I mean, I'm sure there are some interesting conspiracies out there, but, you know, there's not like a ton of them. And, you know, people should not get sort of too fascinated by those kind of things and this sort of, you know, discover the network type stuff that David Horowitz was doing. You know, it just it goes too far, and it sort of distracts people from what, you know, I mean, those of us who traffic in words can maybe influence the ideas that people have over the long term, maybe, which is hard to do, but, you know, probably worth thinking about and trying. And this idea that you're going to somehow suddenly expose the other side as, you know, like all a nefarious conspiracy that will then be suddenly discredited, you know, is foolish.
One thing that strikes me as a little bit interesting about the Kochs being, you know, the poster child for people right now, in the way that Soros definitely was under Bush, and mm-hmm. that Richard Mellon Scaife was, at least in the second half of the Clinton mm-hmm. years, is that unless I'm mistaken, the Kochs destinations or ideas about philanthropy have been more about the battle place of ideas. They haven't been about, you know, kind of an AEI / heritage style. Maybe they donated them too, but I don't think that they have style like, you know, we are the farm team, or, you know, we are the place where people have the shadow governments when Democrats control, and we, you know, do all the talents for when the Republicans gain control. It's less tethered to like political sort of operability, and has been traditionally. And so to see them, and maybe I'm going too far with this, probably am, but to see them as target now maybe speaks to the idea that what people fear is less the organized opposition than the disorganized opposition, or the sort of grassroots kind of Tea Party thing out there, which they have been throwing some money at, as far as I know, and that is interesting. You know, it's.
Yeah, I think that's totally wrong. I think that's a neat conceit on your part, but
self-interested conceit. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, whatever. People get interested. I mean, I think the Kochs have stepped up their activities recently to some extent, and they were involved to an extent with the Tea Party. Tea Party has gotten a lot of attention, so people involved with the Tea Party are getting a lot of attention, so the Kochs are getting attention. You know, I don't know. You know, I heard about the Kochs and their nefarious influence and the term Kochtopus first years ago, from a completely different source, which was sort of like the like extremist libertarian types, you know, the like Liberty Magazine, Rothbard Institute. And I heard all kinds of stuff from them about, you know, like sellouts, like Reason Magazine and Cato Institute with their like practical ideas, and how, you know, this was all about the Koch's business interests and blah, 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 blah. You know, which I think just goes to show people, I don't know. I mean, people like people who give money to them, and they don't like people who give money to other people.
And
I think that's sort of common sense,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
and right. It is pretty interesting. My first exposure to hearing about the Kochs came from talking with a former American Prospect editor who shall go nameless, Garant, you know, when I was in D.C. for some, I think, Institute for Humane Studies event, and she gave me a great chapter and verse of, like, the entire history, and my jaw was just on the floor. I'd never heard of these guys, and I'm like, oh, my God, really? And, in fact, I probably talked more about them with her on that day than I ever have, at least until this past week, you know, when they became in the news, which is kind of fun. But, yeah, they've become a great stand-in for various intra-libertarian, camp splits, which are both real and just completely hyper-exaggerated for fun and sports and personal interest or whatever. There are, kind of classically a couple of different libertarian camps, and have been for a long time. And generally speaking, the Koch funding has gone towards one camp and not towards the other. So it becomes a great way to probe that split. I figure that I will finally know this stuff and understand. I mean, there's also like history going back to the 1980 election, what it all meant, and that day in 88 when you called him an asshole and that kind of stuff. I'm going to finally master that stuff by the time I leave or am fired from Reason. The level of complexity to the very unimportant historical fights will certainly boggle the mind.
Yeah, I mean, nothing beats a good
film. Tell us a little bit about the mechanical workings of the Center for American Progress. I feel like we're, you know, we're talking way too much about Planet Libertarian here. But you are the in-flight think tank of Air Force Two or something, right?
Yes, we are at the nexus of it all. I don't know a ton about the Center for American Progress's finances. Both because we are an institution that, doesn't do a ton of public disclosure of that kind of thing, possibly because we're at the center of nefarious conspiracies, or possibly because, they don't want the staff here to be operating with a, like, constant knowledge of, who are financial masters.
Do you have your, board members?
People just do their jobs.
Board members online, that kind of thing?
Yes. We have our board members. I think it's a reasonable inference that board members of nonprofits tend to be involved in the financing of it. I think the Herb and Marion Sandler, among, infamous liberal donors are, probably the top ones out there on the board.
And you I always hear you guys described either as a Soros recipients or definitely not Soros recipients. Clear the air. Tell us.
My understanding of that is that Soros was involved in starting the Center for American Progress and its affiliated action fund, maybe, but is not currently involved and hasn't been for some time. But I'm not positive about that. But, to really understand any kind of large or medium-sized nonprofit, you have to look, more granularly program by program, right? The people who are supporting our work on education policy are different from the people who support, our work on climate and energy or work on national security, that kind of thing. And the donors don't, always agree with each other about the other things, that they're doing and blah, blah, blah. It gets complicated. I would sort of be interested in some, high quality, right wing, muckraking, that really gets into it. I'm a little curious as to, what our financial basis is. I do work here after all. That kind of thing. I, as best I know, there's not a special Matthew Iglesias angel donor who's, pulling my strings.
You got to get that going.
Yeah, that would be ideal in some ways, and in other ways it would be depressing.
But the basic story is that this was a last decade thing, that it was tied to this feeling that the right had a huge head start in terms of institutions that were producing think tanks and this kind of stuff. John Podesta was involved, is involved in the organization of it, these kind of these and kinds of things. And now there has been, at least some kind of talent back and forth of the administration or with ideas clearly.
I think the idea, specifically was that you needed an institution that was sort of full service. We're not issue specific. We work on a broad range of topics, and that was politicized, in the way that the Heritage Foundation or AEI is, is engaged in the sort of practical political controversies of the day, instead of being very academic. That was an idea that was incredibly in vogue during the Bush years, and we are a product of that era, and I hope continue to do useful work in the present day, even though there's a bit less obsession with that.
How would you put Center for American Progress in a universe continuum with, say, the Brookings Institute? Or there's the Christic Institute. The Brookings Institution and maybe other kind of left of center think tanky type places. Can you draw a picture if there is a picture to be drawn?
A picture to be drawn? Well, I'd say, we're definitely to the left of Brookings to the right of the Economic Policy Institute in terms of our, where I would sort of put us on an ideological spectrum. But there's a lot of other differences just in terms of, what do we do, right? And, what's sort of the attitude there. you know, I think we're supposed to be like more scrappy and engaged than a lot of the older institutions.
Right, like getting into the day-to-day of politics and calling people.
Well, and like we do all this blog stuff, you know, we're hip and new, and we're in the news cycle. It's awesome.
Speaking of the news cycle, Israeli-Palestinian talks happening as this.
I favor peace between Israel. I think that would be good. I think, no, I don't want to sound too cynical about it. I think it would actually be like a really good thing for American foreign policy and for alleviation of human suffering. If an agreement could be reached, and it's important, I am just cynical and pessimistic.
Yeah, I'm cynical and pessimistic to the point of being disastrously disengaged. And have been for a long time, regrettably. The thing that has struck me about it over the years is, again, going back to sort of the America centrist-ness of it, which, you know, maybe makes or definitely makes more sense in this particular case than most things do, given our level of involvement militarily and financially with all kinds of players around there. But I've always been under the impression, I'm someone who thinks there should be a Palestinian state, and that the current system and settlements and stuff like that is unconscionable. Uh-huh. I am of the opinion that it is also just, you know, among the world's biggest bullshit storylines. Is that, like, if you solve this one thing, then, you know, your relationship with the Arab world is going to magically improve. That, like, you know, finally everyone... I think this has been used by nefarious regimes all over the Middle East as, like, their biggest excuse. You know, it's almost like Fidel Castro and the embargo. And you know, even if something great happens, which I think the odds are very small... that we won't get, you know, that payoff that everyone has been waiting for all these years. But again, I'm cynical to the point of numbness.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, look, it's hard to know. I mean, when you look at surveys of Arab public opinion in, you know, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and whatever, I mean, average everyday people there state that they are very concerned about this situation and that they think it reflects very poorly on
them. Oh yeah, I don't doubt that for a second. I
don't think that like King Faisal, whoever is the king of Saudi Arabia, I don't think he's going to like suddenly turn into like a really nice guy if Palestinians get a state. The most important reason that Palestine should have an independent state is, you know, for the sake of the people who live there. It gets easy to sort of start overstating the case about the foreign policy benefits of doing the right thing, because people want the right thing to be done, and so you start marshaling, you know, all the arguments you can. But the most important thing is that, you know, it would be the right thing to do to have two independent states where people can live their lives without foreign military occupation or, you know, terrorist bombs.
There's a significant sort of belief on the broader left that we have tilted foreign policy way too heavily towards Israel over the years, that the nefarious lobby, you know, with a capital L, is pulling at least some strings in our foreign policy, and so on. And there was hope that Obama would sort of recalibrate that, and he's gotten a lot of criticism from pro-Israel people in America for, you know, not being as friendly towards Israel. How would you assess all that? Where do you yourself sort of grade him on that curve?
I mean, you know, Obama has not been as much of a, you know, like, lefty on this as I am. But, you know, I think the conventional wisdom about all of this is, you know, more or less right, that, you know, Obama has been to the left of where the leadership of AIPAC is, but at the same time has not been, like, wildly to the left of something like that. He's taken criticism from a lot of the, you know, sort of hawkish pro-Israel community, you know, and it's because he's not, you know, totally on board with their agenda. At the same time, a lot of Arab advocacy groups are also disappointed with the fact that he hasn't gone, you know, as far as they would like to see. I don't know. I mean, it's almost a bit of a banal situation.
Do you think that his attitude has sort of changed the dynamics of the peace process and that kind of thing, or is it all just kind of, you know...
Well, you know, it's altered the dynamics, I think, relative to where they would be if we had a McCain administration. But, you know, what the United States does is not the primary determinant of events over there. Israeli politics has moved a lot to the right over the past 10 years, and that's not something that George W. Bush caused or something that Barack Obama can undo. You know, they both sort of impact what happens in a way. You know, I think obviously, yeah, I mean, you know, it matters, but it didn't transform the situation. The situation is primarily caused by Israeli and Palestinian actors.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's part of what I think is unfortunate about America's policy in the region is that we're so involved on a whole number of levels, you know, financially, militarily, diplomatically, et cetera, that we leave ourselves, you know, hostage to people who, for completely understandable reasons, are not going to let the United States of America dictate policy to them.
Yeah, it's very difficult to kind of unclench the hand. Or not just unclench the fist in the Obama's terminology, but just your own kind of hand on, you know, various reins and levers and things like that. And it creates its own cycle of people who are dependent on you squeezing it. And I think I'm extending the metaphor to the point where it's now...
I don't understand that at all.
I don't really know what I'm talking about. we're getting close to the hour mark. Want to get what's your take on kind of... after the Republicans sweep into memorable fruitless victory, at least in the House in November, how's that going to change sort of your world, Center for American Progress kind of thing? How is that going to change America?
I have absolutely no idea. I mean, I think there's been a sort of, this is, I think, been kind of the like sort of under-examined political journalistic question is like what does Speaker John Boehner, not like what is John Boehner's real agenda, but like what actually will John Boehner like do? You know, what's his thinking? What's his idea? And then, you know, obviously there will be counterplots to whatever he cooks up. But, you know, I certainly don't know. And I don't think that it's not my impression that, you know, right of center journalism has done a lot of just kind of explanatory or even speculative, you know, work on this subject. You know, I think a lot of what was written in 2008 by liberals about the Obama administration, you know, looking forward, a lot of it's proven to be wrong. Some of it was stupid at the time. Some of it was smart at the time. But it was something people were very interested in, you know, just sort of as a community. People, we really wanted to, like, talk to ourselves about what glorious things were going to come forward. And I haven't seen that same kind of, you know, just like talk about like what are the hopes and aspirations.
I think part of that
for the new John Boehner.
I think that's a function of the fact that Republicans, even though they'll gain seats, have not really been recipients of the kind of unpopularity, the kind of affectation with Obama's governance necessarily. I think their poll numbers still really suck. And the energy and action at the grassroots level is not in the direction of John Boehner. And certainly Mitch McConnell, who's a big a totemic hate figure among the Tea Party people, and that's kind of interesting. I you know, am perpetually cynical about Republicans being in favor of stuff that I'm in favor of. You know, and on the limited government front and sort of libertarian hobby horse front, you know, we haven't seen much of anything of interest, which will be a great relief to you, but not to us. I mean, you hear people say really nice things about Paul Ryan and his roadmap for the future. And by people, I mean people who are into limited government. But you don't actually see much in the way of tangible support for him within the Republican caucus where he works.
But I mean, even if you did, right? I mean, Ryan's plan is not a operationalizable legislative strategy for 2011.
Right.
Right. I mean, because there's just, there's like a separate, there's always like two questions with politicians, particularly in a divided government period, right? And like, one is like, what would they do, you know, if they could get their way? And the other is, what are they going to do in the like actual situation,
yeah.
right? And I mean, so you're going to have, I mean, for something to become law, Barack Obama would need to sign it. For an Obama administration policy proposal to become enacted, House Republicans will have to vote for it. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of bills came out of the Clinton administration during that divided government period, whereas in 2007, 2008, there was almost no, like, real effort by the Bush administration and Nancy Pelosi to work things out. Although, they tried on immigration quite earnestly and, you know, wound up with that going down to defeat. But, you know, I mean, lots of important legislation happens historically during divided government periods. There's a question as to what, you know, as to, you know, is there going to be serious efforts? I mean, it's all, like, worth exploring, but we know very little.
I think it's a great point and a good, you know, story assignment. In general, I think I would expect, at the best case scenario, a lot of super pointless investigations of administration conduct, and then just a lot of gridlock. I don't think that there's going to be much in the way of positive action, certainly in the direction that I would favor, but just in general, I don't think you're going to see a lot of bill creating. It's just going to be, you know, gridlock without the welfare reform or whatever, you know, what was accomplished after 1994 in the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. Maybe that will be fascinating and fruitful for those of us who don't like the government to do more than it ought. But I think certainly it will continue being stupid in terms of the way people talk and act and posture. I think that the interesting political kind of energy and ideas will be coming from without and not within the
but
system.
Don't you think, though, that the sort of 1995 through 98, you know, Clinton-Gingrich era was sort of a high
yes.
point for libertarian policy.
Totally.
I mean, and it's not just that it was gridlock. I mean, they did like this big telecommunications deregulation. They did a big financial services deregulation. They did some like Uruguay round of GATT.
Obama is not that slithery. I think as a politician.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not saying in a predictive vein. I mean, it's just that it's not actually. I mean, it's true that what libertarians want is for, like, quote unquote, the government to not, quote unquote, do a lot. But it's not true that libertarians like don't want elected officials to do things. I mean, there's a lot of legislative accomplishments that, at least in principle, you might support. Yeah, I mean, I'm a little skeptical that we will see, that kind of thing. I think it'll be, you know, a return to that sort of policymaking dynamic. But it's at least possible, it seems to me, that we actually will. I mean, I think there's, a number of areas where there's potential sources of agreement if the political strategists decide that that's what they want to do. You're right, though, that there's a difference between Clinton and Obama, it seems, at least in terms of the extent to which they, you know, are inclined politically to pursue that kind of strategy.
Yeah, and I think that the center of gravity in the Democratic Party as a whole on these things has changed about stuff that I would care about, sort of more deregulatory policies. I don't think there's a great appetite or interest in that anymore democratically. And part of that's a function of the times that we live in, and part of that is that, you know, people's ideas about that changed. So I don't anticipate a lot in that direction, but at the same time, almost every prediction that I've made politically in my entire life has been wrong. So take that all with a grain of salt.
So with that, shall we close up?
I regret that we didn't talk about your barbershop deregulation, but everyone can Google it if they haven't found it already, and let's say goodnight.
All right. Bye.